It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll learn how to have one of the most difficult conversations we may ever have, but one of the most important, a conversation about end-of-life decisions. First, Governor Walker wants to change teacher licensing requirements in Wisconsin. According to the governor, he wants to create alternative pathways to allow a candidate with real-life experience to pass a competency test to gain a teacher's license. This announcement came yesterday as part of the governor's workforce readiness plan and will be included in the two-year budget proposal expected in early February. The measure has been criticized by the Department of Public Instruction and comes after State Superintendent Tony Evers warned on Wednesday of what he calls divisive mandates coming on public education. He sees those coming on their way. By way of full disclosure, my husband works at the Department of Public Instruction. Joining us now to talk about the proposed change to teacher licensing and the upcoming budget is Tony Evers, Superintendent of the State Department of Public Instruction. Superintendent Evers, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. Excellent.
Well, in your annual State Education Convention address on Wednesday, you warned that divisive mandates for public education were on the way. Can you be more specific about what you're concerned about?
Yeah, well, I have to back up to about a 30,000-foot view of this. The concern I have about divisive mandates isn't necessarily the details of what's coming out, but the impact it has upon our 60,000 teachers across the state of Wisconsin. Now, here they are working their tails off every single day to have kids learn to their highest potential. And they frankly don't have the time to watch what the machinations are in Madison. And so they hear just bits and pieces. And, of course, first they hear, well, now we have this accountability bill, and we're going to identify schools as failures, and we're going to punish them by closing down schools and making them into charter schools or something like that. Pow. Then second of all, they come out and the governor and others start talking about, well, you know, this teaching thing isn't all that difficult anyway. All you got to do is kind of know content, and you really don't have to know how to teach. And boom, there's another. It's just this constant drumbeat of divisiveness that comes out of Madison, and I'm just hoping that we can find a way to pause that, to give our teachers a chance to kind of recover and move forward. This doesn't work to put our teachers in this position. We should be elevating the position, not devaluing it. And I think that's exactly where I have major problems with the governor's proposal here. Is it important for people to get content? Yep, you bet. But it's just as important, and that's what our per-present alternative program is all about. We have alternative.
And you're talking about the teacher licensing proposal now that's on the table that says that there's Governor Walker wants there to be an alternative route that people who have what he calls real-life experience and I think a bachelor's degree could then get a license.
Right. Right.
Specifically,
exactly.
What do you see as the trouble with that proposal?
The trouble is that, first of all, we do have an alternative program right now. We do look at life experience. We do look at different content areas. But we are also very specific in our alternative program that even while we do value life experiences, we equally value how to teach. The content isn't how to teach. Content and mathematics doesn't tell you how to differentiate for special needs students, gifted students, and so on. So they completely, essentially what this proposal tells the teachers of the state is, you know, it's not that important to know how to teach. That just comes naturally. Well, that's just baloney. So that's our concern. They've only got half of it right, and by intimating that you don't really know how to knowing how to teach is all that important, they're essentially devaluing the profession, and I think that's a significant mistake.
There are already alternative licensing provisions in Wisconsin for people with experience, but
right.
No teaching degree in areas like mathematics, science, English as a second language, special ed, technology. So isn't this proposal just expanding on something that's already out there?
Well, it is, but it's expanding it in the wrong way. Again, my point is what it expands. It does exactly what we do now. It takes a look at what you've learned content-wise in an alternative program, but it does not do, like we do now, is look at how you teach. Teaching is not just some getting in front of a classroom and yapping and opening up your brain and saying, here's the content, take it. It's communicating with kids. It's all these other different things that are important. We measure that now in our alternative programs. They're suggesting that doesn't matter.
In your most recent budget request, you asked for $613 million in increased funds. Why do you feel that Wisconsin needs an increase that large?
Well, percentage-wise, it's a pretty small percentage. It's barely above the cost of living, and in the past couple of bienniums, we have not fared very well as far as percentage increases in funding. And so, no, we're trying to get back to where we were a couple of years ago. Right now, we rate with some states like Alabama and others as far as the types of increases we've seen in the last couple of years. So it's not extremely large amount of money. The problem I have is that everything we've heard through back channels is that schools will be lucky if they get any increase, and because the state of the economy has put us in a position where there's not much money. And of course, we have to take care of transportation needs and Medicaid needs and all that. So I think it's a reasonable request, especially given what's happened over the last couple of bienniums.
According to the National Education Association, Wisconsin ranked 19th in the country for money spent per pupil on education in the 2012-2013 school year. And that's slightly above the national average, just below Minnesota at 18th, which has been run by Democrats. Do you think it's fair to say, or would you say, that Wisconsin doesn't spend enough on education?
I think we need a reasonable increase. Of course, I believe the people of Wisconsin have supported public education monetarily. And you actually see that in the referendums that have passed. There was approximately 30 passed this last November under very difficult circumstances. And what that tells me is that people of the state are saying, well, if the state's not going to step up, I guess we will locally. And that's just not the state. The state has some financial obligations here, and we can't rely, our local school districts can't rely on local referendum to pass in order to keep the doors open. And on top of it, if we go to that place where locals have to continue to go to referendum to keep the doors open, there will be places that won't be able to pass them, and suddenly will have become a state of haves and have-nots.
An argument that Republican lawmakers make is that it's not really about the amount of funding provided, but it's how that money is spent. For example, Milwaukee Public Schools struggles with the achievement gap, but they have a higher per pupil funding level than a lot of other schools in the state, and a higher funding level than public schools in cities like Chicago and Baltimore and Seattle and Portland. How would you respond to that?
Well, first of all, it's difficult to compare states because different states have different expectations for their school districts. Some states, the building of schools is covered by the state. So I'm not totally convinced that all those comparisons are accurate, but that's not all that pertinent for this conversation. But Milwaukee Public Schools have some, the kids there have significant needs, and to their credit, they're really, the trajectory of achievement has been increasing over the last couple of years, so I support their need for additional resources. And, you know, even with the resources they have, they have some extraordinary high class size loads, 30 to 1 and so on. So, yes, do I think they deserve at minimum an inflationary increase in their costs? Yes, of course I do.
Now, you said in that same recent speech that we talked about earlier at the Education Convention that you felt that Wisconsin had hit at a point, a sweet spot, you called it, between state control and local control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you said, education is very much in the spotlight right now on lots of different levels, lots of different policy considerations. But if you had your way, what would you like to see Wisconsin focus on when it comes to education in the next budget in the next couple of years?
Well, I think what I'd like to have happen, and that goes to the point I was trying to make in that speech, is that we have reached a good place of equilibrium with the department and me personally with the school districts of the state, in that we understand the need for the state to do certain things. We understand the needs of the local school districts to do some things. I'm just concerned that continued activity legislatively is going to shift that balance to even less local control, and we can't have that happen. So my budget, I propose a number of proposals as far as changing the way we fund our schools. That's very important to me personally as state superintendent. Right now our funding system is completely broken, and the distribution of whatever money we do get is not fair, and we need to change the way we actually distribute the money we do. So that's a goal of mine. I will continue to fight for it. I think with so few resources available, it'll be a kind of a truncated conversation. But I think that's a absolute priority. A smaller budget number, but frankly very important, is money for English language learners, those kids that are becoming more numerous in their schools where English is not the first language. Presently, the state provides about 6% of the money for those programs. That's ridiculously low. We need these kids are the future of our state. We really need them to succeed, and they need some more resources for that.
Superintendent Evers, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, Veronica, take care.
We've been speaking with Tony Evers, superintendent of the State Department of Public Instruction. We've been talking about the news yesterday, among other things, that Governor Walker wants to change teacher licensing so that people with what he calls real-life experience can pass competency exams in order to get a teaching license. You can continue the conversation, share your thoughts over on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. Backers of the Menominee Tribes plan to build a casino in Kenosha say Governor Scott Walker's decision to reject the proposal is a setback for the region. But Walker says after months of analyzing the project, he thinks it would hurt state taxpayers. Gilman Halstead reports.
The $800 million casino would have been managed by Hard Rock International, a gambling company that also... The $800 million casino would have been managed by Hard Rock International, a gambling company that already operates a successful casino for the Seminole tribe in Florida. Kenosha Mayor Keith Bossman says the governor's decision ignores the economic benefits the project would have brought.
By golly, for $800 million in investment and thousands of jobs with no state subsidy, I mean, there's no TIF district, there's no money coming from the state to incentivize this. This is all outside investment in the state of Wisconsin. I think it's worth a try.
But Governor Walker says his policies have already created thousands of jobs in Kenosha by luring new companies to the area. And he says the local economy there is healthy and can do without the boost the casino might have provided. He says if he'd approved the casino, the state would be forced to pay the Potawatomi tribe millions of dollars to make up for losses its Milwaukee casino would face if it had to compete with a new gambling hall in Kenosha.
Certainly the jobs are something we looked at, but again, if you're on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars, that's something that even some of the supporters of a casino acknowledge is a pretty high hurdle. And in the end, we tried to get over it. We did our due diligence, as we owe it to the taxpayers of the state to do, but we just couldn't get past that hurdle.
Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says he's disappointed in Governor Walker's decision, but he blamed former Governor Jim Doyle for signing a compact with the Potawatomi that created a no-win situation. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee. The governor announced his casino decision just a day before he speaks at a major gathering of Iowa conservatives who are considering presidential candidates for 2016. But Governor Walker says his presidential bid and religious conservatives generally opposing casinos have nothing to do with saying no to the Kenosha casino.
If that's the case, I would have shut it down right off the bat. If it had been done for political reasons, I would have done it a long time ago.
But State Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca, who's upset with Walker's decision on the casino, says it may have everything to do with politics. The Kenosha Democrat notes that hundreds of Iowa conservatives have signed petitions or letters urging Walker not to expand gaming.
Some prominent people who have played huge roles in past Iowa elections in the campaigns of other very conservative people like Rick Santorum. So you got to ask him about his calculus, how that weighed in the decision.
The Menominee Nation today issued a statement saying Walker's goal of becoming president has helped lead to a no for the Menominee people. At a Milwaukee news briefing, Walker was asked a second time about the timing of his casino decision and his Iowa trip.
I don't think you'll find anybody tomorrow talking about this. What they're going to talk about is what I say tomorrow, and I'm not going to mention this at all.
Walker says during his speech at the Iowa Freedom Summit in Des Moines, he'll talk about how he took on the powerful big government special interests in Wisconsin and how his message is new, fresh, and from outside Washington. Walker had until February 19th to decide on the Kenosha Casino. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
End-of-life care isn't just expensive for patients and their families. It can also have unexpected consequences if we're not prepared. Our next guest wants all of us to be sure to have conversations with our doctors and our families, not just about how to die, but also about how we should live in the final years and months and weeks of our life. He says a good life deserves a good death. Angelo Volandis is with us. He's a physician and researcher at Harvard Medical School and the author of The Conversation, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care. Angelo, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Veronica. Great to be here.
Well, you say that your years as a doctor have taught you a lot about how not to die. What do you mean by that?
You know, over the years, taking care of patients, I've often found myself asking myself when I'm taking care of a patient, what am I doing? What am I doing to this patient who's being admitted to the hospital? And so often, I think if you talk to enough doctors behind closed doors, all of us have stories where we really question, what are we doing? We got into medicine to do good, to help people. And when it comes to the end of life in America, a lot of us are questioning what's going on in our hospitals. Too often, patients have procedures done on them that if they were more informed, they probably wouldn't want. You know, when we ask people in surveys, where would you like to spend the end of your life? Close to 80%, more than 80% of people say at home, surrounded by their loved ones and in comfort. But what are the facts? Two-thirds of people over 65 end up dying in our hospitals, in our nursing homes, often in pain and often tethered to breathing machines.
So what's going on there? If 80% of people want to die at home with their families around them, not, you know, plugged up with tubes in a hospital, why aren't they dying at home?
Well, I hate to say it, but I think a lot of providers just aren't having these difficult discussions with patients and families about what's important to them at the end of life, about what their hopes are, their fears. We just don't prioritize that in healthcare. As a physician, I was taught many things. In medical school, I was taught to be a technical expert with these interventions, taught about reading EKGs and MRIs. But communication training and how to talk to patients is often not prioritized in healthcare.
So it's not prioritized. Does that mean that there's simply not time for it? Is it not part of training? Or is there still something taboo about, even among physicians, about talking about some of these weighted questions about philosophy and living a good life?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. You know, as a physician, I think when I sit down and have these discussions with patients, I necessarily have to confront my own mortality. So I think that's part of it. But, you know, I think the other half is that medical schools just don't prioritize it. And when they do, it's, you know, maybe a couple of lectures throughout a four-year education. And the same thing for residency. We just don't prioritize it as a healthcare system. And especially for physicians who have been out of medical school and residency for 10 years, they never had any training on communication or palliative care classes. So I fear that they are the group that who take care of most of patients in America, and they're the ones who probably have conversations the least.
Well, you want to revolutionize, and you use that word yourself, it's a big word, the way Americans deal with end-of-life care. What do we need to do to get there, to a better place with communication and understanding toward the end of life?
You know, I think there are two things that we can do to really revolutionize healthcare. The first is to put patients back at the center of healthcare. We often talk about in medicine about patient-centered care. The fact is today we don't have patient-centered care. It's doctor-centered care. It's time to put the patient back in. And I think the way to do that is for patients and families to empower themselves, to learn about their options. And one way that I feel we could really get that going is to have patients learn their options through videos, videos that explain to them what their options are for medical care, what are the questions they should be asking themselves, and the conversations they should be having with their families.
And how do we start those conversations? As you said, people don't necessarily like talking about death. What's one way that we can begin it?
I think one of the most common ways that I tell my patients to start the conversation with their loved ones is just to sit down and say, you know, I'd really like to talk to you about what's important to me, about what a good day is today, and what a good day might be tomorrow. But if I get critically ill, the sort of things I would or wouldn't want, what's important to me, what are my hopes, what are my fears?
So it's as simple as beginning with some very simple questions.
It really is. But it sounds so simple, but it's probably the one of the most difficult interventions in healthcare today.
We're talking right now with Dr. Angela Volandis about end-of-life decision-making and how to have the conversation with doctors, with our families, and with ourselves. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have for our guests? Have you been through a similar situation over the death of a loved one that we're talking about today? Have you had this type of difficult conversation where you really think clearly about what you would like at the end of your life? Have you seen it go a way you didn't like with a loved one and you wish you could change that and you thought about that? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with Dr. Angela Volandis talking about how to make the best decisions for the end of life. It's a conversation that many people don't have with their physicians. Our guest wants to change that, and he wants us to have a death that is equal to the life that we've lived. And we want to hear from you. Are you uncertain about how to begin that conversation about death and what you'd like and how to make sure that you get what you need? Do you need some tips for making sure that care is coming your way, and how do you get there? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And we take our first caller now. We have Amy joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Amy.
Hi. This really resonates with me because my dad developed type 2 diabetes, and it went unchecked for quite some time. And I think he was around the age of 73, he started dialysis. And because he didn't live in the same town the dialysis clinic was in, he had to travel. So he would spend about 5 hours every other day, 3 days a week, going to dialysis. And he never really did feel good and ended up having to be taken to a nursing home, moving into a nursing home where he fell and broke his hip. And then they would pick him up with his still really sort of broken hip and put him in a van and transport him to dialysis 3 days a week. And it was just like, it got to the point where it was just awful. He had no quality of life, but no one really talked about not going to dialysis anymore and what that would mean for him. And I'm a baby boomer, and I think a lot of people my age are finding the same thing happening with their aging parents. The conversations aren't being had, but there's lots of medicine and lots of ways to keep them alive and extend their lives. And so it was really devastating for our family, that whole thing.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Amy. And I'm sorry to hear about what your father and your family went through. And I know, Dr. Volandis, that this is not a completely unique story. Amy talking about quality of life as something that didn't really take precedence at the end of her father's life. When you hear a story like that, what comes to mind?
Thanks, Amy, for calling. You know, what comes to mind is my own dad, who had uncontrolled diabetes as well. You know, listening to Amy, I was listening to my own story because no one ever asked him what's important to him. And so often, patients don't know their options. So especially when it comes to kidney disease, no one says, you know, you don't have to do the hemodialysis. There are other options. And it's because all of us as physicians are trained to do the next greatest thing. You know, we have so many fixes in medicine. We have our toolkit, and we try to throw everything at patients, but sometimes we have to know what fixes we shouldn't use. And the only way to know that is to have a conversation with a patient. And I think the description that Amy presented of her dad is something that I've experienced, but that millions of people experience. And I think we're really going to hear many, many more stories like this, because baby boomers are indeed taking care of their loved ones and are facing this each and every day.
So let's look at that kind of story right now. Let's say someone is going through something like that, that's really degrading their quality of life. What are some other options that would be available?
So, for instance, for patients whose kidneys are failing them, a very common situation, most people think, well, I have to do hemodialysis. Actually, that's not the case. There are other ways, something called supportive care, where a physician actually takes care of you with medications, does the best he or she can without having to go on hemodialysis. You know, the funny thing is that when we look at large studies of people over the age of 75 and who are in nursing homes, for those who start hemodialysis, there's actually no benefit in terms of their survival compared to not starting dialysis. It's really, really interesting work that continues to be developed through research. And we also know in many other studies that people who choose a more comfort-oriented path, ironically, often live longer than those who don't.
I want to get to more callers, but just to follow up on that quickly, what do you think went wrong there with not all the options not being laid out on the table?
Well, I think there's two things. First, many clinicians, and I'm going to speak as a doctor now, many of us just don't know what the options are. And so we just assume dialysis is the only option. You know, the national guidelines by the National Kidney Foundation state that for older people who have kidney failure, you know, hemodialysis is one option, but there are many other options in addition to dialysis. And I think the other part of that equation is patients don't know their options. And so if a patient doesn't know their option, they're just going to go along with the doctor because they don't know any better. And that's the part of the revolution in the title of the book is we need to flip the power here between the patient and the doctor. Right now, if the doctor doesn't talk about it, the patient doesn't hear it. Well, it's time that the patient understood their options and bring it back to the doctor and say, hey, I know what my options are, and I want to talk about them.
Let's go next to Allison. Allison's joining us from Ashland. Hi there.
Hi there.
What would you like to share?
Yeah, I'm actually a medical student at the University of Wisconsin. I'm in my fourth year now. And over winter break, I sat down and talked with my aging grandparents. They're 95 and 96 years old. And their physician had never thought that it was important to talk with them about end-of-life care. And they'd never done anything like fill a DNR, DNI form out. That was really surprising to me, to be at the point where you're almost 100 years old and no one's ever talked to you about what you want at the end of your life.
And do you see this, Ashley, or Allison, I'm sorry, is something that's changing?
You know, I certainly hope so. I see that within my own class. We're taught to ask about things like, do you have a power of attorney set up? Do you have wishes for your medical care from the very first time that we talk with patients? And I know that's something a lot of my classmates and I are really passionate about doing. So I hope as this next generation of physicians begins to take over, that will be something that's prioritized, because I think it's important to talk to people about what their desires are at the end of life.
Allison, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate that. And Dr. Volandis, do you see this as a cultural shift that may be already happening?
Absolutely. It's great to hear of students like Allison and the new crop of medical students and residents where they are being taught to have the conversation. They're being told this is just as important as talking about what medications a patient's on, what allergies they have. You need to ask them about what's important to them and what sort of medical care they do or don't want at the end of life. I'm very optimistic. It's just right now there's so many people who are suffering because of this that I wish those new medical students and residents could be taking care of all patients.
Well, thanks again for that call. On to Melanie we go, joining us in Madison. Melanie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm currently taking care of my sister at end of life, and we it's in-home, but we have hospice,
And she has an amazing doctor when it comes to palliative care. But I'm still wondering if there are, you know, if there might be things that I'm missing. For example, one of her biggest concerns is, you know, how do I console her when she says, I'm leaving you with such a mess? I don't want that to be the last thought that is weighing on her.
Okay, some interesting questions there. Melanie, thank you so much for sharing that with us, and I'm glad the palliative care is going well. But what about some of those emotional needs? How do we make sure they're attended to, Dr. Volandis?
Absolutely. Thanks, Melanie, for calling. I think it's important for all of us to recognize that this is a team effort, and it's not just physicians who help patients at the end of life. It's actually social workers, therapists, nurses, chaplains. It's a true team effort. And what we know specifically about hospice care is that it meets the emotional and spiritual needs of not only patients, but also the family. So it really is a holistic approach to taking care of people at the end of life. So I would encourage Melanie to talk to the chaplain, to the therapist, to the psychologist, to the social worker and nurse who's part of her team taking care of her sister.
Well, thank you so much, Melanie, and good luck to you and to your sister. And one more quick call here from Cameron in La Crosse. Hi there, Cameron.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well. What would you like to share?
I'm a nurse, and I've been an ICU nurse for 10 years, and I'm currently a DMP student at the University of Minnesota, and we are trying to facilitate nurses to get into some of these positions of power in healthcare because the backbone of nursing has always been patient preference and patient-centered care. And I just wondered what your guests might have to say about getting some nurses and advanced practice nurses involved in this this kind of palliative care, end-of-life care push.
Okay, thank you so much for that question. And Dr. Volandis, what would you say to that? How can nurses be part of this?
I don't think nurses can be part of it. I think they're the solution to this. Nurses are better communicators. Nurses see my patients far more frequently and often than I do throughout the day or their stay in the hospital. I think the solution starts with nurses, and I think all of us have to recognize that it's the complete healthcare team led by nurses who are really going to transform healthcare by starting this conversation. It's the nurses who see the suffering, who see the toll of not having these discussions. And I really salute Cameron and all nurses to be the leaders in this field and to feel empowered that they could start these conversations with their patients.
Cameron, thank you so much for that call. And Dr. Volandis, before we let you go, I know that a passion of yours is using film to try to help inform patients so that they can make decisions about the end of their lives and what they'd like. How do you recommend using film and maybe yours to get to that place of understanding?
You know, what we know around the country is that some clinicians are good at having this conversation and some aren't. And it's unfortunate because you might be in a part of the country where not many clinicians actually do have these conversations. Well, we don't think you should suffer because you don't have access to these conversations. So what we've done is leverage video technology to help people how to start the conversation. So as part of the book, we have a video. It's at www.theconversationbook.org, which helps people have the conversation for themselves and to become empowered. It standardizes the process. It helps everybody have the conversation.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Angelo Volandis. He's the author of The Conversation, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care. He's also founder of Advanced Care Planning Decisions, a nonprofit organization devoted to encouraging the conversation. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're getting our weekly check of the top state headlines with news guy Noah Ovshinsky. This week, Governor Walker released a controversial workforce readiness plan, and he said no to that proposed Kenosha casino. Noah joins us every week at this time. He's the assistant news director for Wisconsin Public Radio. Hey, Noah.
Yeah. Hey, Veronica. It's good to be here. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday back at you. Well, a lot of stories to do with Governor Walker today. We're going to start off with this proposed Kenosha casino. What did the governor have to say this morning?
Well, proposed no longer. The governor officially announced today that he is rejecting the proposal to build the casino in Kenosha. Now, this plan by the Menominee has sort of been in something of limbo now for for quite a while, and a lot of people have been waiting for this decision by the governor, and here, yeah, the decision came out today.
And as far as the reasoning behind it, what did the governor say?
Right. So the governor said that basically one of the reasons why he couldn't do it, and in fact it sounds like it's the primary reason, is that agreements were reached several years ago between then-Governor Jim Doyle and the Potawatomi, who would be operating a competing casino in Milwaukee, that this agreement essentially makes the Kenosha Casino unworkable. According to the governor, these agreements that were reached several years ago ensures that if the Potawatomi were to lose revenue due to competition, that taxpayers would have to make up the difference, essentially. And Walker argues that taxpayers could be on the hook for millions of dollars if the Potawatomi were to lose money because of this new casino in Kenosha.
And former Governor Jim Doyle apparently had a role in this, at least according to Governor Walker. What did he say about that?
Right. So, he said that Governor Doyle was sort of at the center of these agreements. And really, he sort of put this decision down on his feet, essentially. You know, Walker said, he told reporters today that, his administration acted in good faith. They tried to come up with a solution, but ultimately they couldn't come up with one because of this agreement or agreements that Jim Doyle and his administration came up with several years ago.
And the Menominee Tribe had put out counter arguments in ways that they thought might address the governor's concerns, but not enough at the end of the day.
No, exactly. The Menominee said that they would actually reimburse the Potawatomi for any losses, and therefore, their project wouldn't hurt taxpayers or the state budget, as Governor Walker has said would happen. Clearly, those promises the Menominee are willing to make, clearly that was not enough for Governor Walker.
So this was just announced this morning, but what's the reaction so far?
Yeah, Kenosha's mayor, said that it was worth a try, given all the economic benefits a casino would bring to the area. Of course, we're going to hear from him in a few minutes. Representative Peter Barca, who represents the area, criticized the move. He says the governor is basically turning his back on 10,000, projected jobs and more than $1 billion in new investment. Democratic legislative leaders basically say that this is a politically motivated decision by the governor during a time when he's potentially looking at running for president, and that this will play well among some potential supporters.
Well, in terms of Governor Walker, the big news with Governor Walker this week, until this casino announcement, this is also big news, but the workforce readiness plan has been the subject of a lot of debate, a lot of controversy so far. What do we know about where that is?
Right. So before the news of the casino came out this morning, this really dominated the news, at least the last several days. Governor Walker made a few appearances yesterday in De Pere and Mosinee, and he released what he's calling his workforce readiness plan. And what it is basically is several initiatives and ideas that will come out in his budget, which is going to be released in just a few weeks now. And the plan included several initiatives, but one in particular got a lot of attention. Governor Walker is proposing to drug test everybody, or require drug tests for everybody who is receiving food assistance or is on Medicaid or is receiving other kinds of assistance.
As I understand it, attempts to get people drug tested, other public aid recipients like food stamp people, has been out there already and has been challenged in court and in Florida. What do we know about that?
Right, exactly. I mean, Governor Walker argues that, this will help find jobs. He says a lot of employers are drug testing their employees anyway, and this will remove a barrier to both finding employment and for finding qualified applicants on the part of these businesses. As you mentioned, similar efforts like this have been challenged elsewhere. The state of Georgia dropped its proposal after the federal government intervened. In Florida, a similar plan was also struck down by a federal judge. Governor Walker says, unlike those, he's confident his plan should pass muster in the courts, primarily because it's not punitive. Because under his plan, people aren't going to necessarily be kicked off. If somebody tests positive, they will be offered an opportunity to participate in a free drug treatment program. So the governor's arguing here, it's not punitive. We're just trying to get people the help that they need in order to get a job.
So that's one aspect. And there was another also potentially controversial aspect to this. What was that?
So Governor Walker wants to also cut the amount of time people can receive W-2 benefits. And just as sort of a reminder, W-2 benefits, this is essentially the program that Tommy Thompson created to replace welfare. Right now, people can receive cash payments for up to 5 years Walker wants to cut that down to 4 years.
And in terms of unpacking that workforce readiness plan, what else do we know about what's in it?
There is a third initiative that's getting some attention. Governor Walker wants to create a pathway for people who have a lot of life experience, but not necessarily a teaching degree, to actually obtain a teaching certificate.
And we talked a bit about that earlier in the show as well with Superintendent of the Department of Public Instruction, Tony Evers. And in terms of that life experience and a bachelor's degree, maybe a translating to a teacher's license, does that kind of thing already exist?
Sort of, kind of. There are alternative ways to get that certificate, but they do require, currently, they require either teaching experience or additional training.
And in terms of how this could go down, what do we know?
Well, you know, frankly, we don't have a lot of details yet, but what we do know is that the governor's budget will direct a DPI to create some kind of competency exam. We also know from what the governor has said that this avenue, this to get this teaching certificate, would only be available to teach grades 6 to 12.
And to round up our trio of stories about Governor Walker, we're going to finish off with the governor's trip to Iowa.
Right. So Governor Walker is attending the Iowa Freedom Summit this weekend. And, you know, it's an event that in many ways sort of kicks off the Republican nomination fight this year. Several of the people, including Chris Christie, who are exploring a run for president, will be there.
And what is Walker planning to do while he's there?
Well, he's going to speak. And interestingly enough, this is something that the governor is taking very seriously. The Des Moines Register is reporting that Walker actually has hired a big name in Republican circles to serve as his consultant in Iowa. And, you know, according to that paper, this is the same consultant that helped Mike Huckabee win the Iowa caucuses. So clearly, getting a foothold in Iowa is a priority for Governor Walker at this point.
And the governor has other travel plans. It doesn't stop at Iowa. Politicos are watching this so carefully right now, his every move, his every travel motion. Where else is he going?
Yeah, busy agenda. So in addition to the Freedom Summit, the governor is also planning to attend an event in California this weekend hosted by Freedom Partners. That's affiliated with the Koch brothers. It's basically their one of their fundraising arms. And so he's going to be speaking there. In February, Governor Walker is going to speak at the Conservative Political Action Conference in D.C. And the Wisconsin State Journal is reporting that he also plans to go to New Hampshire. Of course, New Hampshire is another key primary state other than Iowa. And he plans to make that visit in March. According to the State Journal, he will be a keynote speaker at a GOP event that is billed as grassroots training and rally. So a busy few months in store for the governor.
Now, I'm no expert, but looking at all the places the governor is going, Iowa, New Hampshire, Freedom Summit, it looks like somebody who's prepping to run for president, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. This is what one would expect of a potential candidate. It's getting into those early states, the caucuses and primaries, and it's getting in front of people who have big wallets to get these commitments for funding and money. Those are two things that any candidate, and in fact, you'll see other candidates who are looking at a run doing the exact same thing, you know, getting their name out there in Iowa and New Hampshire and raising money.
Well, Noah, thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate your time.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Veronica.
We've been speaking with Noah Ovshinsky. He is our assistant news director for Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back on Monday. More Central Time is on the way here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.